Welcome to the AgTech So What podcast, brought to you by AgThentic. I'm Sarah Nolette, and today's guest is someone who's looked at the agriculture industry from a range of perspectives, from growing up on a farm in Kentucky to solving big problems for corporations and governments all over the world.
I get kind of frustrated with the idea that it always gets down to, oh, it's the data, show us the profits. I think sometimes, you know, especially with technology, we think about things now like soil health. Why don't farmers, you know, they're silly, right? Why don't they adopt technology? Why don't they do these soil health things? It's like, well, actually, it's all really still too hard. And giving them more data is not going to make it simpler.
That's Mary Shellman. She's the former director of the Harvard Business School's Agribusiness Program. She also sits on multiple strategic advisory boards, is a venture partner with Radical Growth, and has a degree in chemical engineering. Mary is asked to speak all over the world on agribusiness, and after listening today, you'll understand why. She begins her story the way she likes to start all of her talks.
I always start by saying, you know, you'll see that I live in Boston. I was at Harvard Business School, but I'm from Kentucky. And not only am I from Kentucky, my dad was a farm equipment dealer there. And then when I was in middle school, he bought one and then a second farm that are they're held on to each other, hooked on to each other. So basically, when I go back, I say I was born into this. You know, my parents on both sides were in Kentucky for many generations beforehand. Always in agriculture, always too poor to own their own land. So it's in, but I never had any thought that I would actually have a career in this space. I'm a chemical engineer by training, only because somebody in high school said, hey, I'm going to be an engineer, Mary. I think, you know, you like math and science. I think you could be an engineer too. So I did that. But when I found myself at Harvard Business School back when dinosaurs roamed the earth, basically so many years ago, I met this guy by the name of Ray Goldberg, and he was teaching a class in the second year called Agribusiness. And I thought, well, I don't know what to take, but I'll take this. Maybe I'll know something about it. And that was just really this great turning point. I love, first of all, at Harvard, it's all about the case method, and I love the case method. And when I got to agribusiness, I love that because it was all of these cases. And I kind of, because I had gone around with my dad growing up to work on equipment or to sit in the farmer's kitchen table at night when he was selling them equipment, trading equipment for them. It's just like I had some experience with it, but I loved it because it wasn't just about the farming side. It wasn't just about the food company side. I loved all of the many dimensions of it. So Ray asked me to stay after I graduated for a year and to write cases with him, to write case studies, and I did. And I did like 13 in that year. It was crazy. Oh, I was in Australia twice. As a matter of fact, you'll appreciate this. Talk about a story. I wrote a case on elders back when it was with John Elliott. And I actually got to go with John to the footy championship in Melbourne that year. So it was kind of a big time and, you know, so interesting space.
Our Australian listeners will know who John Elliott is. For others, he was the president of the Federal Liberal Party, and when Mary met him, he would have been a prominent businessman and president of the Carlton Football Club.
So I did that, and it just led, you know, one thing led to the other, and I've spent time in academia, I've spent time in industry, and today I get to do lots of fun different stuff, which is a combination.
Actually, you might not know this, Mary, but I took Ray's class in the last, I was in his last class that he taught. I sort of finagled my way in and was like, I've heard about this guy, you know, I want to do agriculture and I need to get into this class. And so I took his last class and similarly was, I was already pretty hooked, but even right. More hooked, especially by those cases. But I imagine maybe some of those cases you had a hand in or actually wrote some of. So we might have intersected there.
We probably did. If you've read cases, you probably read them. But did you do it at the Kennedy School or at the business school? The Kennedy School, right?
At the Kennedy School. Yeah.
Yeah. I was going to say, because he ended up across the river once he became kind of aged out of the Harvard MBA classroom, he kind of packed up and moved across the river and then he packed it all in. Right. So you wouldn't just do one case in a class. You would do like 12.
Oh yeah. 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 You would do so many. Yeah. And he would put everyone on the spot, like all these, you know, students sitting there expecting they can kind of cruise through the class. And he'd be like, well, what do you think? No, that's not a good answer. What do you actually think? What would you actually do? Quite intense. Mary, you've spent a lot of time recently talking about sustainability. How did that kind of come into the, like when did you start talking about sustainability in agriculture?
Well, it's interesting kind of story. I guess it was like many people, it was there. So when I came back to Harvard in, it was 2005. So basically things were still kind of, crop prices were low, you know, big harvest in the world. And we didn't think anything about it until, you know, a couple of years later, and suddenly, you know, all the prices are out of whack. And we realized, you know, the world woke up one day and said, hey, we have to feed a big population that has different kinds of needs. And at the same time, resources are limited. And back at the 2005 to 2010, you started to hear more about sustainability in the world. And I was writing cases at the time. So you just kind of heard about this, but it was in that area of greenwashing. Always comes from Europe first, right? That's where we were hearing it. But then I started working with the Irish food industry in 2010. And my colleague at Harvard and I were invited in to write a strategy for the company. This was just at the collapse of the Celtic Tiger. The economy was in the tanks. There really wasn't anything left there in the country except agriculture, which was the country's only indigenous industry. They have no manufacturing. They had IT, but that left. They have financial services, but that left with the collapse. So my colleague and I looked around and we said, you know, look, there's kind of interesting opportunities here. First of all, you're too small. You know, it's always going to be, you're an island. It's going to be high cost. So you're going to have to brand your way out of this. And you're too small. So you need to go to the market with power. It would be great if you went out with kind of one positioning. And by the way, the world is starting to say, you know, we really want to know where our food comes from. We want to know how it was produced. You know, we care about these things. And here you sit, you know, right next to Europe, this very large market. And, you know, you could have access and you could basically say to them, hey, look, if you care, come see us. We're here. So we could kind of think about, you know, green, clean, natural place. And we didn't say position on sustainability, but we said that you need to brand, you need to have more talent in the industry, you need to have more innovation. And that idea went to the Irish Food Board, Bord Bia, the entity there that's in charge with basically promoting Irish food and drink around the world. And they spent a couple of years actually looking at that. And they've been hearing from their customers in the UK in particular. So Irish beef and dairy went into retailers like Tesco and Sainsbury. They were starting to hear that, hey, you know, we want these sustainability dimensions to come into the food. And maybe we'll start looking at that around, you know, carbon and then water and then animal welfare. So they put together after 2 years this program called Origin Green and introduced it. And national level sustainability program with teeth because it's data driven. One of our pieces of advice to them as a country was, look, you can't just go out with a marketing claim. You actually, to build a brand, you have to have the data to back it up. So what Origin Green is really a sophisticated system of collecting data. And that data begins on the farm and goes all the way then through the supply chain. And that was really, you know, seeing the power of that and watching the evolution. When we first presented the idea to the Irish food industry, they're like, oh, this is crazy, right? It'll never work. And then kind of 2 years later, when we introduced it, Origin Green was introduced, it's like, oh man, why didn't we have it sooner, right? This is fantastic. You know, this gives us something to talk about. And in particular, they said, this gives us a framework. We're already doing a lot of great things, but we don't have a way to bring it all together. And I think that was the real power of Origin Green. And we've seen over time now that was introduced in 2012. You know, you kind of fast forward to 2020, 2019. And this promise that's out there with the data to back it up has been able to open the door for Irish food exports, you know, into Australia, beef into the US, many other countries around the world who are saying, hey, we believe, you know, this is what actually consumers want. And, you know, we like this promise.
Yeah, that makes a ton of sense. What I found interesting there, like many countries, especially now, talk about how they have a clean, green reputation. Yeah. And in Australia, we talk about that all the time as kind of a pillar of the food and agribusiness industry here. But I'm not sure there's many countries saying like, we don't have that anymore. And so that data piece is probably really key to actually differentiate and prove that what you're saying is true. Do you know anything about how that kind of got rolled out and how, or how it was done in a way that wasn't kind of burdensome to farmers?
Right. It was, well, first of all, Ireland already had a quality assurance scheme in place for beef farms. And they had been doing that for a number of years in order to raise quality. And so that scaffolding was there. On the dairy side, the individual co-ops had some of their own quality programs, and some of those included sustainability dimensions. But, you know, but I believe that there was already some level of trust with the farmers in the system. And then it was a bit of carrot and stick. So on the dairy piece of it, it was the co-ops. It was convincing the co-ops first. It actually took much longer on the dairy side than the beef side to put together what the sustainability, kind of what that would look like, that would roll out at the farm level. But then they were able to suck it up through, right? You know, because they could require it, because you're delivering your milk there, you know, the truck shows up. And so to do it, it's like, here it is, you know, if you want to get on the truck. But on the beef side, because, you know, there's like these three big beef processors, like many places, you know, a lot of, you know, fragmented beef farmers who have a handful of cows, and they can choose where to sell them to. And so that was a little bit more about the carrot rather than the stick. And again, you know, you could have these comments, you know, down through the sustainability audit from the beef side, but it took a lot. So the Ireland, they developed what's called a carbon navigator tool. Sounds, you know, now pretty basic, but back then it was actually pretty innovative. They'd work with a carbon trust out of the UK and actually were able to go out to farmers and say, look, if you did this, you know, you could actually get this back, right? This is a payback on this, or this is how you're doing. And when it was first went in, it was really about getting farmers used to collecting the data. So they were already used to doing quality data, but then it was like, oh, we want to know now what you're doing, your water use, your carbon use, your biodiversity. And the first part of it didn't you know, there really wasn't about teeth or having a standard. It was saying, we just want you to get used to collecting this and turn it in. And then, so it was very sophisticated, I think. The program Orbio is very well thought out in terms of how you actually move something through, not just like plunk, we're going to do it, but thinking about that implementation plan, which was so key. The other piece around that, you know, having the data, you said, hey, you know, having the data is probably interesting. But once you have the data, it not only says, hey, I can back it up, but it also gives you this feedback loop, right? So now you know what you're doing. So you can figure out what works best, and then you can go and you can do some more of it. So it's about the differentiation today, but then it's about continuing on the journey. And I always like the way that Ireland kind of defines sustainability as a journey of continuous improvement, rather than saying, here's some checklist, you know, if we check these boxes, we're sustainable, you know? Yeah, but do you actually get better over time?
Yeah. One of the things you said there that's really interesting to me is the different kind of leverage points in the system for who can drive change. You know, in dairy, you're aggregating supply. And so the processors have a lot of that power. In beef, maybe it's different in different industries. You've also looked at companies and their kind of sustainability transformation, where maybe within their supply chain, they have significant amounts of power. Any kind of comments or insights on how you've seen that kind of power dynamics able to drive change? Because that's quite a key, you know, you can say, let's have this program, but doesn't matter if no one adopts it.
Exactly. And, but, you know, so I think there's a couple of dimensions on it, right? One is the financial dimension, right? So good friend of mine in New Zealand, Nicola Shadbolt, she's a dairy farmer. She actually explained to me what she does is grow grass, but she's also a professor at Massey University. She was on the board of Fonterra, very well respected. And I was visiting Nicola, and I'll never forget, she said to me, you know, Mary, you know, farmers do what you pay, know what you say. So the financial incentive is a big deal, but it can't always be the financial incentive, I think, in some of these cases. But the other dimension of it is actually, do you know, the biggest challenge that we have in agriculture is that you're so fragmented at the farming level, so fragmented at the consumer level. And then in between, you have these, you know, very big middle folks who gate information flow. And so how much information actually gets exchanged down the chain? And one of the things that we've thought about kind of in looking at this, so how does that information flow down? And sustainability audits are one way that information flows down. So if you look at somebody like Danone, what they're doing in the US with their dairy farmers and, you know, the claims that they're actually making, what they want to build is, it's like, you know, we want to be transparent, but we'll put this in the audit. And that's a signal of what we want. I think, again, it's harder on beef because it doesn't flow through, you know, into a system as easily.
You mentioned the kind of big middle there. One of the other things we're seeing is kind of pushback against the scale of agriculture and this kind of sense that big is bad, you know, big food, capital B, capital F. What are you seeing in that space?
you know, so there's kind of two pieces of it, right? You know, we all kind of, you know, love the idea of the underdog that gets out, you know, the small guy that makes it big. But yet at the other side, we have to, you know, feed the world. And there's, you know, there's a lot of different starting points and there's a lot of different needs out there. The idea to me, I think that's compelling is that the system needs to, again, to be improving over time. And certainly we've had a lot of, you know, people are challenging the existing, the traditional system as we've seen it over the past few years. And I think that's a good thing. But yet at the end of the day, the power to use scale for good, you know, that's a term that you'll hear from, you know, the Cargills or the McDonald's in the world, you know, the big buyers out there. It's like, hey, once we move, we can actually move the needle. Olam, a company that I admire tremendously because they're out basically sourcing, you know, across Africa and the world from 3.5 million smallholder farmers. How can you reach 3.5 million smallholder farmers unless you have somebody there that's saying, hey, we can actually organize this? There's a real pushback, this idea that big is bad. But I think what one of the things that COVID has taught us here in the US that you know, big actually means that you can be more resilient, perhaps, than a smaller entity because you have more financial resources there.
Mary has found over the years that big and small companies can both be good or bad, but often and increasingly, they're better when they work together. This might be through open innovation, investments, acquisitions, or partnerships. One of Mary's favorite examples comes from a can of tomatoes.
I mean, it's, you know, so the question is, you know, where does innovation come from? You know, where does the pressure come from? Where is the pressure to innovate, right? You know, and one of the things that we know is that innovation tends to come whenever you have the tightest constraints. So if you look at India, the Indian farmer that's out there and they're so innovative, the African farmer, they're so innovative, right? Because they have no resources, so they have to figure out how to make it work, the ones that survive. Whereas big companies, and I think this has really been true in the US, they get kind of, you know, I won't, you know, kind of fat and lazy, right? You know, lots going on. We certainly saw it here in the beef industry back a few years ago, whenever, you know, the US industry basically was bought out by companies like JBS, who came in and said, we see all these opportunities to take margin out of the system. At the end of the day, you know, beef's kind of a commodity and we don't think, you know, having like luxury offices and, you know, big, nice, you know, carpets on the floor and things like that. We don't think that actually adds value to the consumer or to the supply chain for that piece of it. And it opens the door, exposes folks. One of my favorite companies, so I'll tell you a story, one that I love to tell. So it's a company in Italy called Muti. And they, what do? They process tomatoes and they basically buy tomatoes from farmers in the field, and then they put them in cans or in jars and they go on supermarket shelves. And it's basically only tomatoes. And they're a real quality leaders, but let's face it, right? You know, kind of field tomatoes are field tomatoes. And then you put it here, but they've been able over time to say, hey, instead of kind of beating up our farmers by kind of pushing down the price, we want to add price incentive for better quality, because if we get better quality from the field, that's actually translates to better quality in our jar, our can, because we're not adding anything to this. It's just basically the tomato in the here. We don't put anything in. And so they, you know, introduced a positive price grid rather than a discount grid, which is so common in agriculture. It's like, let's beat up the farmer. It's like, let's bring them along. And then, you know, and then they also introduced something, they call it the Golden Tomato Award. And basically they ask farmers to collect data all year long, and then they measure quality at the end. And they basically pick some winners, like there's the big winner of the Golden Tomato Award. And then there's like, you know, smaller winners out there. Apparently it's it generates a lot of pride to be selected as this recipient of the Golden Tomato Award. And so I think, you know, we get back to thinking about, you know, how do you drive change? How do you encourage change? It's a blend, right? You need information to flow down. You need the financial incentives to flow down. But then there's this pride element to it as well, that you want to make people feel like, you know, you're doing the right thing and on the team, and, you know, that your name can be in the newspaper
Yeah, 100%. And the human element, right, of all of this. I think we sometimes talk about systems and complexity and incentives, yeah, and like there's humans in there too, and tapping, yep, into pride and emotion and health and well-being, like all of those things are absolutely critical, especially in agriculture, given the nature of what it is we do and what it's like along the supply chain.
Well, I think there's kind of that element, which, you know, gets us into this area that I've been fascinated by recently. So you hear it's like, oh, only 37% of, you know, the farms in Ireland are economically viable. And in the US, it's the same way. Like all of these farms, they're not profitable. But yet we know, you know, my experience all my life is that these are really smart people. You know, maybe it's not the traditional book smart of having, you know, a PhD from Harvard or something, but the ones I know, they're really, really, you know, sharp. And they certainly understand that. But I think what's happened is that we tend to think, you know, as economists in particular, about this definition, traditional definition of profitabilities, right? It's like your income minus your expenses, and that's your profit for the year. But yet there's all of these intangible elements that go into what's going on there. And it's like, you know, maybe it's lifestyle, but there are tangible benefits of that lifestyle that don't get calculated into that equation. And so, you know, health might be better because you're outside. I think now COVID makes us all aware, you know, that we need to be outside more. Being in nature has a positive benefit. You know, raising your kids with traditional work values, work ethics, this piece, being able to have your family together and working in an operation. So I get kind of frustrated with the idea that it always gets down to, oh, it's the data, show us the profits. I think sometimes, you know, especially with technology, we think about things now like soil health. Why don't farmers, you know, they're silly, right? Why don't they adopt technology? Why don't they do these soil health things? It's like, well, actually, it's all really still too hard. And giving them more data is not going to make it simpler. What's going to make it simpler is things that make it simpler. So it's whether it's a recipe for it, or, you know, maybe like a Fitbit, you know, that you measure soil health, you know, in a way that there's multiple dimensions to it and you get some kind of feedback. So these things that, from a technology standpoint now, that I'm very interested in are the ones that, again, they bring in this benefit that you don't get down and kind of measured on that profitability line as simply.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. We had someone on the podcast a while ago. He's a farmer in Australia, and he went over to, I think, maybe a Scandinavian country. And as you're walking through these farms, and they've got like 3 cows and this like beautiful hillside, it's like, how could this farm be profitable? And it's like, well, the system was set up to pay these farmers to farm this way because they're creating this other benefit, which is the beautiful scenery that they create for the tourists to come live in it, and the lifestyle that they have for their people and the society. And so we're starting to see this kind of blend of what the role of the farmer is. Are they just, mm-hmm, producing a commodity, or are, right, they producing other services and benefits as well? And I think the challenge to your point is, without kind of clarity and technology and data on what actually is working, is the, yeah, benefit being produced, right, it can all feel like a bunch of mushy greenwashing, which is frustrating for everyone.
Right. And I'm the first to say we need data, right? But I think we need data to, you know, so, you know, how do we know? As an engineer by training, right? I know that unless you measure it, you can't control it. But if you start to measure something, then you just start paying attention to it because it's there. You know, like, again, like your Fitbit that's telling you, your Apple Watch that's saying, hey, today, you know, you had 5,000 steps and you really, your goal was 10,000. So tomorrow you work a little harder. So it's these little nudges over time, I think, that change behavior rather than like, oh, let's sit down and have some eureka moment.
Yeah, exactly. In the work that you've done and some of the cases you've looked at, are there any examples of really good implementations of technology?
You know, traditionally, if we look at things around precision ag, they get perhaps bought, but then they don't get used. And it's like, wow, you know, whose fault is that? Is it the farmer's fault? And you always hear this, I think, so much of the time from, especially from the young tech companies, right? It's like, oh, you know, the farmers are slow adopters, right? They're just so slow, you know, too conservative. But yet again, at the end of the day, farming's been around for a long time. They've been around for a long time. And I think they've been burned over time. It's like, well, gee, we've gone down that path before. You know, why should we go down it again unless something is pretty compelling? But you turn back and you look at the adoption of Roundup Ready soybeans, you know, in the US and Brazil, something that when they first were introduced really had a yield drag rather than a yield benefit. Very, very fast adoption. And that's because it's suddenly growing soybeans was a really simple thing to do. You know, I remember my dad, when he was farming, he hated soybeans, loved to grow corn. Now the farmer that farms my land loves soybeans. It's basically soybeans for dummies, right? You know, anybody can grow a crop of soybeans, but corn is hard.
Yes. That's such a fascinating example. What's your thought on the kind of unintended consequences of perhaps the easy button there in some ways, and especially the pushback from a sustainability perspective on that?
Yeah. Well, you know, it's tough. So living here in Boston, I'm, you know, kind of live in this land of consumers that may be in that pushback side. But yet, you know, when I tell a story and say, let me tell you why, you know, we grow Roundup Ready soybeans on my farm in Kentucky, it means that we don't have to, you know, spray the fields as much. We don't have to drive the tractors as much. We certainly don't have to plow. We can use conservation farming. And then the story becomes more compelling, right? Because you're talking about the things they care about. The other thing that I think that there's such a misunderstanding on, and it's, you know, the use of chemicals in farming is, again, it comes back to, you know, farmers are kind of, you know, they're not silly and they're so careful with those. They're so expensive, right? So they're so careful. And it's like ounces in huge sprayer tanks. And I think that, you know, the typical consumer says, oh, look, you know, I go and I buy this, you know, bottle of Roundup or weed killer and I just like spray it all over the place. It's like, there's no way a farmer would ever do that, right? Because it's down to, you know, the minimum that you need. Interesting that kind of over the years, comparing Europe to the U.S., and Europe has always been focused on the MRAs, the minimum, you know, residue that you can have. But just because you can measure something down to that level doesn't mean that it's bad, but it focuses consumers' attention on that. Even then it's like, it's crazy, right? There's no way, where the U.S. has always been kind of focused on a different kind of food safety elements, more about the pathogens, right? Is it salmonella? Is it E. coli? Is it something else in the system? And, you know, we don't think so much about, and then you get these mixed messages out there. But, you know, when it comes to, you know, the genetically modified crops, I just think from a sustainability standpoint, we have just never nailed about being able to explain. And I don't think consumers want to be explained to. I don't think they want to be educated. I think they want to be engaged. And somehow we still haven't found the right voice on how to do that.
One thing that Mary has certainly found a way of explaining well is how agriculture companies find different approaches to becoming more sustainable, whether they choose financial incentives to nudge farmers to change behaviors or look to ag tech to disrupt the whole system. We're seeing all kinds of responses from companies big and small. Mary and a colleague came up with a framework to organize a bunch of the insights from the case studies they've been working on. Mary explains it, and you'll have to start picturing an X and a Y axis. It might feel a bit like sitting in class in Harvard, but it's worth it.
Back at the beginning of the year, we said, is there a way that we can actually kind of simply explain this? Because, you know, like company X does this and company Y does this, and you've got all of this commentary, these, you know, different stories. And we came up with a very simple 2x2. Think about this. The X-axis is financial incentives. So you started talking about financial incentives earlier and about sustainability. And the Y-axis, we said, okay, that's information exchange. Because does that information get to the level or not? And then we kind of sat back and said, well, what do we actually have? It's like, wow, these are different pathways to get to a sustainable food system. And they're different pathways. And just because you have a different pathway doesn't mean that you're not going to get to the journey. It's just that you're taking a different approach to it. And that kind of lower left-hand corner quadrant, kind of low information, low financial incentives, we would call that the defend box. And those are the folks that are doubling down on productivity. You know, it's about sustainable intensification. It's not that they're giving up on sustainability. It's there, but it's about sustainable intensification. It's about, you know, increasing yields with using less resources, but basically saying, hey, the traditional food system that we've had, agricultural system, is actually very effective. And if you look back over, you know, the course of the last 50 years, you know, the amount of water, the amount of feed that it's required to produce, you know, say a gallon of milk here in the U.S. has gone down significantly. And that's true all over the world. And that's because we brought technology in and we've really been focused on, you know, kind of increasing productivity. If you go kind of up in that quadrant, so you're up, still kind of low on financial incentives, but higher on information exchange. And those are the companies that are out there to, we call it develop. So they're using sustainability audits and other signaling mechanisms to say, hey, consumers want more. So let's meet them where the consumers are. You know, and we can do that by saying, you know, we want biodiversity, we want better water use, we want, you know, better carbon. And so I'd put Ireland's Origin Green up there in that box. I'd put Danone in that box, you know, in terms of what they're doing. And again, being more responsive to consumer needs, but doing it through information more than they're doing it through financial incentives to the farm. And then you move to the two boxes on the right. So the upper right-hand side. So now I've got pretty high information and high financial incentives. And here the financial incentives are coming from capital markets, investors out there. And we would put the plant-based proteins in there. So like we still need protein, but we need a different supply chain to get it. So we're not going to use an animal supply chain. We're going to use whether it's soy or, you know, pea protein or potato protein or whatever. So companies like Impossible Foods, you know, Beyond, all of these many, many new entrants that we've seen. Last year was, you know, definitely the year that these alternatives, plant-based meats, just burst onto the scene. And we say, well, they're out there defying. So they're defying the idea that protein has to come from animals. They're saying, you know, there's a different source, you know, different supply chain from that. So we need the farmers to grow more of these proteins that we're going to put in, the plant-based ones. And so that's different from the animal guys. And then that lower right-hand box. So still high financial incentives from the, you know, investors, but basically no information exchange. And these are the guys that are out there disrupting through cell-based meats, through fermentation-based, you know, dairy products, like Perfect Day in California. So basically, you know, we can make a dairy protein that's genetically equivalent to an animal, you know, dairy protein from a cow. But we do it with genetically modified yeast, and we're not apologetic about that. And we do it with a, you know, kind of a little bit, you know, with sugar basically and water. So, so we don't need land-based production at all. And I think by framing it that way, these different pathways. And again, the idea is not one that's right or wrong, but at least we can get our minds around some of the conversation that's going on.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's really helpful to kind of categorize it. And I was a little worried when we talked about a 2x2 matrix that I wouldn't be able to picture it, but you've explained it really well and with good examples. If you're a farmer seeing this kind of play out, and maybe you've participated as part of a particular supply chain, what kind of optionality do you have, or are you seeing, like, is this kind of happening to you, or what do you think in terms of how proactive, you know, you can be if you're on the farming side?
That's a really good point. I mean, we typically think more of it, you know, as a food company point. It's like we see a lot of optionality in there. So, you know, companies like the meat companies like Smithfield, you know, will introduce a, you know, a non-pork product, you know, a plant-based product, or Nestle, you know, plant-based product. But what happens at the beginning of that supply chain on that piece? I think, you know, one of the bigger points there is that just that you need to, as a farmer, you need to keep your mind open that this big disruption could actually come. And you think about, you know, what that could potentially mean for prices in terms of, you know, whatever you have, whether it's, you know, animal prices. Certainly if you're raising animals today, if you're raising beef, you know, I would say you need to be clearly in one camp. You can't be caught in the middle, right? So that's the middle's always a kiss of death. You need to either be, you know, really low cost or very highly differentiated. And again, this was the Irish story, like can't be low cost. So you have to be differentiated on something, but you better be watching the signpost out there that says, how sustainable are these industries going forward? Because that could be the game changer, right? You know, if demand goes down significantly, not just for beef or pork, but for the feed grains in particular that go into those industries, then we have a complete change in the system in terms of the revaluing of land. And it's really hard to see, you know, where that value would come from. I heard Pat Brown from Impossible Foods on a webinar the other day. He said, hey, don't worry about it. You know, all those farmers out there that are growing, you know, corn and soy, they can get paid for their, you know, carbon sequestration. It's like, I don't think so. I don't think that's a market that's going. I think that, you know, that would be a big change. And you can't wish it away.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's right. That, like, hope is not a strategy.
Hope is not a strategy here.
Mary, when you think about the future of the food system, what are you most excited about?
I will certainly the idea about technology is going to give us the ability to measure and then hopefully control more than we have in the past. You know, the more we understand something, I think the better decisions that farmers can make. You know, we can do a better job in terms of using resources in a way that is in an effective way of doing that. And I think that goes all the way through the system, right? You know, you think about China, which is a country that I think is so important for the world. And every time after I talk, when I give a talk in the world, I typically talk about global trends. You know, after I tell everybody I'm from Kentucky and I actually have a farm background, so to make people think that, you know, there's actually some reason to listen to me, you know, I always start by talking about China, because it's just, you know, they're the market setters, and the market setters for the past 10 years will be the market setters for the next 10 years, probably, until it's just, you know, too many people changing diets, you know, limited resources in the country. They'll never be able to solve it. But I think what, you know, we're going to be able to do all over the world is make smarter choice about where to invest those resources, those limited resources. So does it make sense for China to, you know, to use the water that they do have, you know, to grow corn or, you know, something like that, maybe rice. I think rice will always be grown there. Or does it make sense to grow, you know, to grow a higher value crop, to put it into something that has a bigger piece? So I'm very excited about the, you know, technology and, you know, just being able to understand more and be able to make different decisions.
Yeah. I want to ask you one last thing, Mary, that came up twice now. You've mentioned kind of coming from Kentucky. I would say, you know, that it's something I'm fascinated in, that you have to, in this industry especially, kind of build that credibility of I grew up here or I was in this industry. You've got degrees, you've done case studies all over the world. Like you're very clearly an expert in this, whether or not you grew up on a farm or in a farming business. Why do you think it's so important to kind of establish that credibility, or do you think it's important or just custom? It's something I think about a lot. I'm curious.
Yeah, I don't think it's just custom. I actually do think it's an important part of credibility, because being inside that buying unit, right, by being there and sitting in that seat. So when I was at Harvard in business school doing my MBAs, you know, we'd sit around the room, you know, and read case studies. And you'd approach it very intellectually. And, you know, so many of my classmates were already very experienced. But you know, how do you really understand the value system that exists, right? There was this, in some ways, you'd look at people that maybe didn't have the same level of education that you had, you know, that, you know, chose to live in some rural area instead of a city. And there, I think there's a bias that says, hey, you know, that's a bad decision, or maybe this person isn't as sharp, or they would be doing something else. And this is true even from some of my colleagues at sure. Harvard Business School, you know, at the faculty level. It's like this assumption that, oh, it's the third son that gets left on the farm, right? Because they can't do anything else. But I know that's different. And I've been there and lived that. And so I guess I go back to it just to make sure that I can establish that connection, so that what I say then can land in a different way. Mm-hmm. Then the idea that, you know, here's somebody, she's flying in, you know, she right. lives in Boston, where, you know, it's very different. She goes all over the world, you know, she speaks to these groups. And so I need to be real to that person. I need to be real to a Fortune 100 CEO as well.
Yeah, that kind of translation between the two, for sure. And sounds like, I mean, at least where I end up on that personally is, I didn't grow up on a farm, but I've spent time on hundreds and hundreds of yeah. them and sat around those kitchen tables. And so, you know, you bring your own lens on it, and you didn't yeah. grow up where you didn't grow up, but you yeah. do have that credibility and appreciation to talk at all different levels of this. Yeah. So, and I think that's what we need more, because if it's only the same voices that have done it the same way, then all the changes we've just talked about for the last hour, I think struggle to happen, but you also need that grounding.
And I think it, you know, and I think there's the other part of it that's very well, I think as an industry, you know, agriculture as an industry, we need to open the doors and say, please come out, please spend time with us. This is the best thing you can do. And again, you know, COVID maybe gives us that opportunity, because people are thinking about, we need to get out of cities. I know lots of people in, you know, Boston this year decided to grow a garden. And I'll tell you that most of those, from what I kind of glean on the Facebook list, they have been kind of unmitigated disasters. And that's great, right? Because now you've learned this is actually really hard. Totally. Right? It's what is this thing eating my tomatoes? And it's like, well, it's a rabbit or it's a bug, or it's just like, oh man, now I have to go like buy some expensive thing to treat it. And you know, so I just think the more we can make it real, the more we can invite people in, the more we can, you know, show that you need the data, but you also need people to be sitting in the seat and understanding the complexities and the nuances and how dynamic it is, rather than thinking, oh, this is just like, you know, cooking out of a recipe book and you're always going to get the same result every time.
And that's it for another episode of AgTech So What. Thanks for listening. If you're still trying to picture that 2x2 matrix, we have it up on our website, which is linked in the show notes. And if you've enjoyed this episode, please leave us a review and tell your friends so they can find AgTech So What. I'm Sarah Nolette. Catch you next time.